Welcome to Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast, the podcast that pulls back the curtain on the evolving world of sports science. I'm Andrew Rizza, an athlete trainer with decades of experience in professional, collegiate, and high school sports.
And I'm Cameron Roth, an orthopedic surgeon and a consultant for the Chicago White Sox.
In each episode, we'll explore the real-world challenges and opportunities facing today's human performance professionals.
Our hands-on experience is transforming sports medicine and breaking barriers through innovation and teamwork.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to this week's Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast. This week, I have Eric Cressy. Eric is the president and co-founder of Cressy Sports Performance with facilities located in Hudson, Mass. and Palm Beach Gardens in Florida. Eric joined the Yankees organization back in 2020 as the director and player of health and performance. Eric is a certified strength conditioning specialist and registered strength conditioning coach emeritus through the National Strength Conditioning Association, which is a designation reserved for coaches with two decades of experience in the field. Eric, welcome to the show. I appreciate you taking the time tonight.
Thanks for having me. We go way back, so this is long overdue.
Can you just give a brief overview about yourself and, you know, where you are today in your career?
Sure. So, you know, I think like a lot of strength and conditioning coaches, you know, I was a mediocre athlete at best. You know, I look back on my training or my sporting career, and even with maybe the expertise that's available nowadays, I probably would have been a very average Division II athlete as my ceiling. So those who can do and those who can't coach. So I went to the University of Connecticut for my grad degree, kind of not really sure what I wanted to do. Started out actually thinking I wanted to do more strength conditioning research. Our lab at the University of Connecticut wasn't a true biomechanics lab. It was much more focused on exercise endocrinology and things like that. And just so happened to get an opportunity to get my foot in the door in strength and conditioning there in a volunteer role, and really just caught the strength and conditioning bug and, you know, finished out my grad degree there and went to the private sector after doing a lot really in basketball and soccer. But it just so happened that the first athletes that I really started to work with in the private sector were baseball players. Realized that they were, you know, a very underserved population and not necessarily getting the attention that they deserved. You know, you have people who just got the, you know, foo-foo rehab program, and then people who got the college football strength conditioning program. We realized pretty early on that there was a nice, you know, kind of middle ground that you could push guys really hard as long as you were aware of what some of their unique needs were. And just so happened in 2007, not far from you, we opened up the original Cressy Sports Performance in Hudson. Things kind of took off by leaps and bounds. And, you know, a lot of those high school guys became college guys became pro guys. Before you knew it, we had, you know, basically players in all 30 organizations. We opened up the second location in Florida, kind of became a one-stop shop for baseball development, where it wasn't just strength conditioning. We also had physical therapy, massage therapy, pitching, hitting, analysts, just tried to create a place where guys could get everything they needed under one roof. And then at the end of 2019, the Yankees reached out to me. I had worked as a consultant for the Minnesota Twins for 2018 and 2019, kind of dipped my foot in the shallow end of working in professional baseball. And then the Yankees reached out at the end of 2019, and I just finished my fifth season with the team. And, you know, fortunately, but unfortunately, went to the World Series and lost there. But, you know, certainly kind of like a cool opportunity, you know, amazing honor. But, you know, just another challenge to scale and to, you know, oversee a pretty large department across many states. You know, we have a Dominican Academy. So I'm intimately involved on everything from obviously direct player interaction, programming, driving organizational initiatives, trying to, you know, be a higher, I guess, level visionary for a lot of the things we're trying to achieve, but also doing stuff with amateur draft, pro scouting, you name it. So I kind of have my hands on a lot of different things, which is, it's just fun. No 2 days are alike.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome from where you began to where you are now. I mean, I think it had to have been pretty much around the 2007-8 year when you guys opened in Hudson. John Beverly, our baseball coach at Weston, introduced us, and we had a bunch of athletes that had gone over to see you over at your performance center in Hudson. And then some of those players went on to play high collegiate, and one of them was close to going professional, but he went the other route and became a business guy, and he's probably making a lot more money as a business guy than he would have as a professional athlete. But I think, yeah, it's great for you. I'm glad you landed where you did with the new facility down in Florida, the Yankees organization. And believe me, you guys are going to have a lot more shots at getting to the World Series and winning one. So hopefully our Red Sox can do the same with some of the spending they're hopefully going to do this offseason. So now your brand, Cressy Performance, you said you had kind of hit it like with the baseball players in that kind of realm. Is there anything outside of that that you guys touch upon with overhead athletes? Do you do anything more with overhead athletes besides baseball? How does that work in Florida compared to in Hudson?
Yeah, absolutely. Baseball is always going to be the core competency, but I think once you've dealt with overhead athletes in that realm, you know, we have NFL quarterbacks do quite a bit of work in actually tennis, which has become quite a big niche. And then obviously the rotational capacity and us being in Palm Beach Gardens, I think it was something like 6 of the top 10 golfers in the world live in Jupiter. So we actually have a pretty strong professional golf, you know, demographic as well. It's taken on down here. You get volleyball as well. So before you know it, you're dealing with overhead athletes that, you know, are exposed to some of those extreme positions across a variety of mediums on a daily basis, for sure.
Yeah. And I mean, sure, the weather's a lot better down in Florida than it is here in Mass. It was 25 degrees today.
Oh my gosh. It was 73 down here. People were freaking out, wearing sweatshirts.
That's great. It's great. What are some of the key exercises, just, you know, thinking overhead athlete? I mean, obviously we're going to focus more on baseball this evening, but when you're dealing with baseball players, what are some of the key things that you would, you know, you're prescribing for those athletes?
Yeah. I mean, I think at the end of the day, before you ever think about somebody as a baseball player, you're thinking about the person you're in front of. You know, I mean, at the end of the day, like, you might have athletes that have crazy kyphotic thoracic spines, you know, and it drives a ton of scapular anterior tilt. And we might have another player that walks in, you know, and has, you know, an aggressive military posture, really flat thoracic spine, you know, their shoulder blades are pinched to their, you know, together, crazy rhomboid dominance, aggressive scapular depression. You might have an athlete that's very, very stiff. You might have an athlete that's very, very loose. So I think at the end of the day, what's really served us well is always just focusing on the person in front of us before you ever get to sport-specific commands, you know, emotionally separated from what a baseball player should do. And instead, you got to think about, what should this person in front of me do to put them in the best position possible to actually go and even attempt to throw a baseball? You know, I certainly have some strong feelings about some of like the classic exercises in the baseball community. I think, you know, we see a lot of people who have just been coached down and back, and you know, we see like kind of a whole era of, I think, strength and conditioning coaches, rehab specialists who have just overlooked the role of serratus anterior and some of that stuff. So, you know, I think where we've maybe differentiated ourselves is we've gone with a very archetype driven approach. You know, everything that we do is driven by what we do in our movement screen. So we're not going to take a kid who's a ultra stiff, wide infrasternal angle, you know, kind of evaluation and tell them to go just, you know, throw like Aroldis Chapman or throw like Jacob DeGrom. Like, that's not going to be a good fit for them because that athlete just doesn't have that kind of rotational capacity, doesn't have that kind of laxity. So I think the secret is to know that there isn't a secret. The secret is to get as much information as you possibly can, have a good pool of exercise that you can pull from, and then, you know, prescribe accordingly.
I'm glad you touched upon that too, the way you addressed it, the assessment in front of you, like, who's in front of you, how are they presenting? We talk about that the same way in physical therapy and athletic training. How are they presenting? How are we screening? What's their mobility look like? So for you as a professional looking at your athletes or your staff, what's your go-to for assessment? What are you using for tools to be able to do that?
Yeah. First things first, I always try to do some legwork ahead of time. I never like to walk into an evaluation cold. You know, it's harder to do when you're seeing like a, you know, high school 15-year-old or something like that. But I always make sure I get some level of information on the front. And probably similar to you getting a new patient that comes in, you're going to find out, hey, they had an ACL reconstruction with, you know, this surgeon. So you know that surgeon's tendencies, you know their preferences, all that. So I always like to get a little bit of that. And it usually comes in the form of email or like questionnaire on the website, or, you know, maybe they've talked to somebody in our office to get the evaluation scheduled. You know who their agent is, you know, what team they played for, all that. I like to just be curious and spend 5 or 10 minutes digging in on, you know, all right, they throw a splitter, you know, really high vertical release height. Oh, maybe it's a guy who's got limited shoulder ER and that's where he goes. So I kind of have some of my clues that I work to, but the first thing always starts with a thorough health history. And I tend to pry more than I ever did before, just because I think we see so many athletes that just, you know, check boxes as they go through it and they aren't really, really, you know, meticulous with it. So I try to pry really heavily, not just on previous injuries, but medications, anything like that. I want to know a little bit more about their history just to make sure that I'm hitting the ground running. Once we actually get in the office, we're going to go through, you know, detailed conversation of what are the goals, what's the training history, you know, what's the timeline, are you here for 3 days, are you here for 3 months, you know, what are we working with in that regard, you know, are there any exercises that, you know, give you problems. I often like to integrate one of our skill coaches as well. So if I'm dealing with a pitcher, I want to get one of our pitching coaches in there, just because there are a lot of things that they may say that, you know, I can write down, but it's good for them to hear it because they'll sometimes have just a different kind of context for it. And then once we've kind of gone through the conversation, I go right to a, you know, in the case of a male, a shirtless posture assessment in the office. We look at static posture. While I'm in there, I'll do some manual muscle testing for the rotator cuff. I'll do the SFMA cervical screens. We'll do also SFMA, like the single leg balance score. We'll do a toe touch in there. And then I'll look at some scapular control stuff. We'll look at shoulder flexion, shoulder abduction, external rotation when the arm's adducted. And once we've got some of that information, you know, we'll go back out to the floor where our training tables are. We'll go through a pretty kind of comprehensive joint range of motion screen. Look at hip flexion, ER, IR at the hips, hip abduction, you know, active and passive straight leg raise, infrasternal angle. We'll look at both true shoulder flexion, and then we'll look at a, you know, traditional shoulder flexion measurement, ER and IR, both shoulders. We'll look at, you know, elbow flexion, extension, pronation, supination, lumbar locked rotation to look at thoracic spine mobility. And then we'll get them up. We'll do, you know, ankle mobility screen, just looking at dorsiflexion. We'll do an overhead lunge walk. Depending on what I see earlier in the eval, I may also look at like a lateral flexion test. I might use the on-base U lunge with extension test if I think we have someone who's like a really compressed, narrow infrasternal angle or something like that, and they can't extend sufficiently. And then overhead squat, push-up, just looking at some of the scapular control measures. And from there, usually we'll get them set up with like an individualized warm-up on their first day. And then we run some force plate jumps. We use Hawkins, looking at everything from peak power to what the graph shape is, to jump momentum, to asymmetry side to side during, you know, different phases of the jump. And then we'll also do a Proteus test, which basically is a rotational power screen that, you know, we can also look a little bit arm speed as well if we're looking at some algorithms to really kind of predict some pitching success as well. And then from there, it may be go outside and play catch with our pitching guys, then come back in and actually go through a thorough strength conditioning session just to see what your work capacity is like, how you handle coaching, things along those lines. And then almost all those athletes will have a follow-up skill-specific evaluation where they sit down and then they break down everything in really, really crazy detail with our pitching department where it's, you know, it's looking at pitch shapes, it's looking at usage, all those different trends because we're trying to map out what they want to be and how we get them there. So it's, I probably forgot some stuff, but it's pretty extensive. Yeah, they're you know, position players, well, we may do some stuff with the timing gates where appropriate. Usually we'll just go force plates and then get that kind of as part of training as we follow up. But, you know, we actually just brought in 1080. So that'll be something that'll probably evolve a lot of our speed testing on the front end as well.
Yeah. So a little bit more extensive than just an FMS, right?
Yeah, we've gone way past that. I mean, it's you know, it's screens versus assessments, right? I think that there's an inherent difference, and it's really driven by I never wanted our training model, or excuse me, our business model to dictate our training model. I always wanted to make sure that, you know, if we were going to be price leader in the area or something like that, I wanted to make sure that we were thorough in everything that we did. And don't get me wrong, like that might be more minimized if we have a 12-year-old kid who's completely detrained that, you know, just needs to come in and start up. But if I'm looking at a 27-year-old big leaguer with 3 years in the show, like I want to make sure we're giving him every possible chance of being success. The other thing too that probably relates, you know, even more to what you do is I'm a big believer in test retest. Like if I see something that's a little bit wonky, like I'm spoiled. We got, you know, quite a few manual therapists in the building. We got 3 physical therapists and a chiropractor / massage therapist. I love to just treat and see what shakes free. Like, all right, yeah, go work on his thumb for a few minutes and let's see if it gets him some elbow extension and some supination. You just never know what you're going to be able to unpack. So I love a lot of test retest, particularly with respect with manual therapy, positional breathing, stuff like that. And I think it opens up a good opportunity for some learning, and it probably builds some buy-in with the client on the front end as well.
I mean, the test retest is huge with us too. I mean, we talk about it all the time. Like that's how we're getting most of the good data that we're looking for and making sure the patient or the athlete can buy into what we're trying to do for them, right? So it is important. Now, with that type of assessment, if you're looking at, you said like more big league versus college, high school, youth, what's the timetable for, so when someone comes in, like what's an average visit for you when they come through the door? If they came in to see someone at Cressy Performance and they need an assessment, what does that look like on their end?
Yeah, we can do, I'd say, everything on the physical side of things in about 90 to 120 minutes, I think is a good rule of thumb on that. 60 would be very, very tight if we actually want to get some measurable training impact in. I think where it tends to go longer is when we also roll in some of our skill evaluation, where we're actually talking with hitting and pitching coaches. And in many cases, we'll just have those guys do it separately. If they're going to be regular clients, we might say, all right, listen, we're going to book your you did your evaluation on a Monday afternoon. We're going to book your pitching meeting for Wednesday morning at some point where it's, you know, it's just a chance. And not only that, like the last thing you want to do is have an athlete sit there for 4.5 hours while they're hungry at the end of an evaluation. I usually like to have like the office stuff take place on the front end when they're fed, not all sweaty and all that. So we just try to schedule it correctly, but it does create a lot of administrative headaches to get it all in.
Yeah. Both ends of it. Are you getting, you know, someone coming out of rehab, going back to throwing, you're getting someone that's just not doing well with their placement and their pitch speed and their release. Are you seeing that client as well, and then people that are also trying just to develop to get to the next level?
Yeah, we got all of it. You know, we have guys that have 18 years in the big leagues. You know, we have guys that are, you know, first year draft picks who haven't even gotten out of the FCL or the AZL. But yeah, I mean, at any given time, we're usually doing 4 to 5 high profile MLB Tommy John rehabs. Just, it's kind of like, it's something that's taken off as a niche. It probably happened even more so because when COVID happened, you saw more and more high profile, you know, rehab cases kind of go outside of the team where they just did it in the private sector. You know, you tend to see more 1 year contracts in baseball. So if a guy blows out in May with his team, like, he can, you know, he can go rot at the spring training facility for an extended period of time, or in some cases they're saying, you know, just go rehab at home and workers' comp will cover it. So invariably we usually have a few of those that are taking place, certainly in the off season. So yeah, right now there's quite a few. Unfortunately, baseball's in an era of, you know, elbows exploding and thoracic outlet and shoulders and all that stuff. So unfortunately we're busy in that regard. But, you know, to your original question, like, I talk with our physical therapist. It's my first conversation every day when I get there. I drop my daughters at school. I walk into the facility at about 8:11, and I usually have 19 minutes before, like, our 8:30 crew. Usually they're actually there when I'm there, and they're just kind of foam rolling and talking about fantasy football. But I always try to check in with our PTs first thing on the day, just because those are the guys that often require the most collaboration across departments. And it's usually time when I can grab our pitching guys as well, just to be, all right, this guy's going to be off the bump for the first time. Make sure he doesn't try to hit 95. So there's a lot of that that's taking place, though.
Yeah, it's good. A lot of collaboration, a lot of talking to each other, which is key. I mean, just like us with post-surgical cases that come through the PT or the athletic training department, you're talking to the doctors about the rehab protocol and making sure that all the staff understands what that's supposed to be. So you're not having somebody do something that they shouldn't be doing day one, like you said, 95 first day on the hill. It's not good. So
yeah, and I love the variety too. Honestly, like, right, you know, we had two ankles that came in at the end of this year. We had one patellar tendon cleanup on a big league relief pitcher. You know, like I said, I think it's probably 7 or 8 elbows. Probably 5 or 6 of those are major leaguers, and then, you know, a couple more minor league guys that are mixed in. We've got one shoulder that's further along. Like, we have one thoracic outlet case. It's just, you know, I appreciate it, and honestly, I'm like a meticulous note taker. I'm a crazy with my documentation. I think I have a pretty good memory for this stuff, but I'm really, really big on, like, evaluating guys and making sure I document it well, so that, hey, a year from now I come back and look at these notes and I can see how an athlete may have changed. So that's what's cool about this. And we opened this facility in, you know, in 2014. We moved into our bigger showcase location at the end of 2019. So really we've got 5, 6, 7 years of data on some of these guys, just to see how they've responded to increases in workload and stuff. So we can just be a little bit more of an advocate for them and encourage them to speak up when things might be trending in the wrong direction.
Yeah, that's great. I think you can never be too detailed, because you don't know who's going to pick that up. If someone else in your office comes in and wants to see what happened to Jay Smith last year, like, they can go and they can look that up, and it's precise, right? What are some of the, when you talk mobility, you know, you talked a little bit about thoracic mobility, a little bit about hip mobility, just kind of scratching the surface. Do you talk to the athletes about yoga? Do you talk to them about more just functional dynamic warming up or stretching? What's kind of the discussion on improving their ability to be as best as they can be?
Yeah, I mean, I think you can attack them from a few different avenues. Certainly, we talked about manual therapy earlier on. I think some people do need that help to get over that hurdle. What else? You know, dropping a dry needle in an infraspinatus, or in some cupping or some Graston or something along those lines, even just, you know, hands, ART, you name it. All those things are on the table. You know, I think positional breathing is something that's obviously low risk, and you can get some pretty high payoff for the right people. You know, if you understand, you know, how to drive airflow just a little bit differently, I think you'd, all right, hey, we need some IR, we're going to chase some anterior expansion. We need some ER, we're going to create some posterior expansion. Like, those are things that we just start to learn. I think Bill Hartman's work is really a difference maker in that regard, if folks haven't seen it. And certainly even before that, we were exposed to PRI and a lot of things that you can learn just by shifting people out of, like, a classic left AIC posture. So we'll do a lot of that. You know, there's certainly, like, an element of, like, traditional dynamic flexibility. There may be some static stretching, maybe some capsular mobs, there may be some banded distractions. We actually did start doing, I don't even know if I would call it true yoga. We call it yoga, but it's definitely more like FRC. I don't think we stay in really static positions for an extended period of time, but every Wednesday morning, a ton of our pro guys do that. We kind of close down our cages and got a nice, like, little outdoor or semi-outdoor space where the guys can do that. And it's been very, very popular. So I think everything is on the table. Like I said, we have a chiropractor on staff too, if that needs to be, you know, in play. But, you know, certainly you got to have a lot of tools in your toolbox, because, you know, two guys are going to, you know, respond the same, and you're also going to have some guys who unfortunately, they've got a big old bony block that isn't going to go anywhere. So you've got to learn how to work around it, or when appropriate, refer it out and see if they're a good fit for a different kind of, you know, intervention from someone in the sports medicine community.
Yeah, I mean, the diaphragmatic breathing stuff has worked huge for us, especially with mobility, thoracic and lumbar spine, even and cervical spine, just to improve that mobility. And people don't understand how easy it is to do and to get great results from it. And that's, like you said, that's the easiest thing you can do to get the result. Then you can work from there and you have everything available. Like you said, the capsular stuff, any type of other modality that you can provide hands-on is key. So you guys are definitely hitting all the good things, which is great. And I'm sure the athletes appreciate that it's so comprehensive that it makes a difference in their daily life.
Yeah. And I think we've probably the biggest difference maker is getting exposed to fascial manipulation. You know, that school of thought, obviously the Stecco family has done some wonderful presenting more internationally, but to see it come to the US and start to get rolled out, like that stuff's incredible. You know, seeing somebody get work on their ankle and all of a sudden improving, you know, hip abduction by 40 degrees or something like that. Like you just see these pretty pronounced changes. But more than anything, it makes you realize why certain times, you know, someone got a treatment, it just didn't stick. And then they got a different treatment and then they were good for 2 months. So it was very, very eye-opening. I was fortunate. My business partner was really kind of early to market with it and got really, really involved in it. You know, I've kind of been around it quite a bit. So it's something that I think has been, you know, if there are, you know, clinicians out here who are manual therapists, like I think fascial manipulation has been the biggest difference maker of probably any discipline we've come in contact with.
Yeah. I mean, you look at the athlete or even patient coming in and you can't just focus on the area of restriction. You have to look at everything above and below it. We talk about this all the time where you have to always think of there's something else restricting that motion that's causing the problem. So let's try to figure it out. And you said it best at the beginning, it's individualization, trying to individualize the person that's in front of you. It's about them. It's not about you. It's trying to make sure that we're providing the best treatment to get them to their goals. And that's something that on an intake, like what are your goals? Simple, short-term, long-term, how do we get you there? This is what we're going to do to get you there. And that kind of leads to the next question. When you look at developing programs for youth, collegiate, and professional players, like how big, that must not differ that much. It must just be, hey, we're going to do more advanced stuff with a professional athlete than we might do with a youth athlete, right? And what does that look like?
Yeah, for sure. It's actually really funny. I'm giving a talk this weekend. Dr. Mod puts on a baseball sports medicine conference. And I'm talking about scapular control, but I was going back and actually reviewing a presentation that I did for a staff this summer, just to talk about like kind of how we batch athletes. And let me preface this by saying, I think that a lot of young strength coaches, clinicians, whoever we come up, they want the ready to print program. They want something they can just like roll out conveniently. And it's just, you can do that, but you're going to have some big swings and misses. And frankly, you're not going to really care for the people that are in front of you on a level that you probably aspired to when you got into this as a career. So everything we do is individualized. I spend a ton of time writing programs. I probably wrote 20 of them this weekend, and each one of them took a lot of time. You know, that's what it takes. You know, every hour of training is going to require an hour of planning. But, you know, to your earlier point, like we're very big on batching athletes. In other words, you have your wide infrasternal angles and your narrow infrasternal angles. You have your hypermobile guys and you have your loose guys. You have your hypermobile and your tight. You have your lefties and your righties, your left AICs and your PECs. But like I actually went through and the algorithm for me, I listed this out on a slide. I just pulled it up while we were on this call. Infrasternal angle, breakout range of motion, all the table tests, anthropometric characteristics, laxity, injury history, age, physiological profile. That could be all the blood work stuff, sports specific motor control. So the stability you have at the requisite end ranges, work capacity, what your force velocity, you know, profile is on force plates. What's your force velocity profile on a Proteus? So the plane bias, you know, in our pitchers, we look at wrist predisposition. Do you love to radial or ulnar deviate? What's your natural onslaught? You know, is there an element of transfer or interference of training? In other words, if you're already deadlifting 600 pounds, if I push to take you to 605, I'm probably going to make you a lot worse in the process just because there's a cost to be paid for it. You have to consider the timeline, right? What I can do for a guy who shows up January 1st is totally different than what I can do for a guy who's here October 1st, the first day of his off season. You know, what's the delayed transmutation timeline going to be? And then what's their competitive calendar, which frankly, I think is the single most important conversation we need to have with our athletes that really gets overlooked is like, how can we plan out a year to keep you healthy or, you know, in the case of rehab situations, to get you back and not, you know, miss steps and have setbacks along the way.
Yeah, no, I agree 100%. I think that was, you know, you talked, I mean, basically a second about force plate technology. We talk about wearables. We talk about other training devices, markerless or markered, 3D capture, motion capture. How does that kind of play into this whole process of the rehabilitation or the performance piece? And what's kind of your go-to? There's so many things out there right now. What do you guys focus on the most, and what do you feel is the best bang for the buck?
Yeah, I never would have expected that I would spend this much money on technology. I'll say that. And I don't think it's keeping up with the Joneses. You know, like, hey, you see another facility doing this. I think it really comes down to, like, this is our best option for giving athletes the best chance to develop. So I think you certainly have, like, baseball-specific technologies, things like TrackMan, Edgertronic cameras, Rapsodo, all those different things that are pitch tracking metrics. Like, those are very, very important, because you can do everything right physically, but if you're throwing a 70% spin efficiency four-seam, it's probably not going to be a very hard fastball, and it's certainly not going to climb like a four-seam should. So, you know, nothing matters that we do in the gym if guys are ripping off accidental cutters all the time. But I would also add, we invested pretty heavily in Thea markerless, which is a bunch of cameras that we can take out on field to actually do a markerless biomechanics setup, you know, in their normal habitat. In other words, it's not on a turf mound in a lab. We can actually take it out on the field, and it's been absolutely fantastic. We've seen some pretty dramatic differences where you see a guy where they do a Thea report and they actually realize what's taking place. We integrate it with what we do on their movement screen. And you see these guys that'll go 88 to 94 in a single bullpen just because there was something so wrong with their sequencing. You know, we had one of the best pitchers in all of minor league baseball came and saw us. He was an absolute dumpster fire from a hip mobility standpoint. Big old right-handed pitcher who was living on the third base side of the rubber. We went through his whole Thea report. We pulled it, you know, his pitch grades. We talked at how inconsistent all his pitches was. And the single biggest takeaway from all of it was to just move to the first base side of the rubber. He went out and he was arguably the best pitcher in all of minor league baseball this year, and his hip felt exponentially better. Why? He just stopped chasing big positions that he couldn't get to, and just orienting him to a different point on the rubber allowed him to work so much more cleanly. So, you know, I mentioned force plates. I mentioned Proteus. We're bringing in 1080. We use timing gates. I mean, heck, we even have, I always said I was going to fight wireless speakers for the music in the gym, but you know, here we are many, many years later and we're doing it. And I still think I probably know how to use the coffee pot best of all, but you know, everything is just, it's not pen and paper check-in anymore. It's an iPad you check in at the desk. It's just crazy how it's all happened. And you know, we're living on the cloud and doing stuff in that world as well. And that's just like the tip of the iceberg. That doesn't even sniff, you know, some of the resources that we have in professional baseball. You know, there's things like Kinetrax. Obviously, Hawkeye provides some powerful stuff. You know, a lot of the GPS options out there, whether it's Catapult or, you know, other techniques, you know, to gather distance travel, speeds tracked, all these different things. And all that stuff is, if you're curious, you just like to nerd out with data, there's so much that you can learn from them. You can understand why some athletes are the way they are, why guys, you know, are just fighting to recover between sessions because they're covering 30% more yardage than any other guy on the field that night. They kind of just live in the red. So it's very eye-opening to see some of that stuff.
Yeah, I just had a conversation with Mike Cianciosi, who was the former sports scientist for the Red Sox, and person that took over for him, Owen, who's there now. We were just chatting about basically applied sports science analytics, where I end up getting another master's degree in because I wanted to nerd out again with some numbers and figure out the best thing for my athletes and how do we kind of bundle that up. And that's why I really wanted to talk a little bit about the stuff that you guys are using. But my big thing was sleep performance. And I felt like if there's one thing that I can grab that's inexpensive enough for me to be able to have a difference with the athlete, it's their sleep. I know if I can improve their sleep.
Rocking an Oura Ring, so.
Yeah, I know. I wear a Whoop. So if you can control it, you have a lot of things available to you between cognitive function changes, performance changes, rehabilitation changes, tissue healing changes, like all that stuff we know that happens. So if we can do that, that's a great step in the right direction. And then if we stumble upon some funding that we can do other things like GPS and speed gates and all that stuff, that's all great. So I think what you have available to you, it's just another piece of the toolbox, right?
Powerful. Yeah. And even the blood work is more exaggerated than it's ever been before. The things that you can do across not just regular health, but obviously in the performance space as well is really, really powerful for sure.
And I think it all comes back to, you said at the beginning of the conversation, like getting the most detailed medical history from the athlete and the subjective from them to be able to pull what you need to understand what your assessment is maybe going to be turning towards. So you can actually get what you need from that athlete to be able to build what you need for them to get to the goal. So all the other stuff is kind of like that shiny and nice and looks good. And you have to have all the stuff, the foundation before to be able to get to the end, right?
Yeah, none of it matters unless you're savvy about how to actually create conversations with athletes about it. Like Andy Galpin did an amazing podcast all about sleep. It was one of his first ones on his new podcast. And one of the biggest takeaways is the single best way to actually improve sleep is to encourage people to stay in bed, to have a conversation about sleep, and then let them know it's okay to extend your sleep. Just literally by an hour, stay in bed, don't get up. Because so many people, like you, I'm sure you do it, like you roll out of bed and it's 4:50 and you're like, you know what, I'm not really that tired. I got all these things I can do. I'll just get up. Or like, what would happen if you just stayed in bed till 6:30 and woke up naturally? Like, it's a big hour and 40 minutes that, you know, people just miss out on.
Yeah. And I think the other key thing is they got to put their device away an hour before they go to bed. And that's the problem. We can't get them to do that. Figure it out.
I'm guilty of it too. There's just too much stuff to accomplish. That's the problem.
That's right. What are some of the common misconceptions that you end up seeing or needing to deal with or address with players? Like, what is the biggest thing that you, over the years of from you first started to now, how has that changed, or what is the biggest thing that you're dealing with?
Yeah, there are things that change and some that don't. I think, you know, the thing that hasn't is guys are always going to be looking for a quick fix. You know, they think there's some magical supplement or some like fancy weighted ball program or something like that. At the end of the day, it's hard work and consistency. That hasn't changed across the 17 years that we've been, you know, we've been open for business between Massachusetts and Florida. Like, that's the one thing that is incredibly consistent. What has changed? I think the circumstances in which athletes, you know, work. Obviously, social media is a very new thing. Twitter didn't exist when we started CSP, and you know, now it not only exists, it's got a different name. It's X now. You know, like Facebook was kind of the only thing that was around back then. And now if you're on Facebook, you're, you know, a dorky old guy. So, you know, I have no interest in being on TikTok. CSP is on TikTok. I don't really do anything with it, but that's just kind of the nature of where it's gone. There's just so many different noises and platforms and all that stuff. So I think maybe one of the things that it's stopped me is I need to have a tactful strategy for the long term. When I'm not the cool young guy. In the past, it was great when I was 27 and I could relate to all our high school athletes. Now I'm 43 with three kids. So I'm just the bald old guy that's not cool anymore. So you have to have a young staff that keeps you at least reasonably hip.
I was talking to a colleague and a really good friend of mine, Wally Collins, who owned founder of Collins Sports Medicine back up in Massachusetts here. And he had said, like, back in the day when I was coming up, he was kind of the young guy too, where he got to go out and meet everybody. And he got introduced to, you know, got business with the Patriots and the Red Sox and the Celtics. And then all of a sudden they started introducing him to all the big leaguers. And that's how he grew his business. And he goes, now he's like, I'm the old guy. And all these young athletic trainers, strength conditioning coaches, athletic directors, physical therapists don't know me. So he had to bring in one of his nephews, who's now the young guy on the block. And he's talking all the G League guys, and that's where he's, you know, continuing to grow his business. So I think there's a lot to say with, I think, you know, what we've done over the years and how we've gotten better at what we do. I think we know how to deal with people better. We know how to deal with the athlete more efficiently. And then hopefully we could pass that on. And I think that's where the mentorship of what we do every day can be very helpful. And the athletes, I think, see that, the organizations see that. If we start to look at, you know, we talked obviously about what you guys are doing as a business, which is amazing, how you're developing the athletes, who you're looking towards, you know, youth, collegiate, professional. According to the research, there's obviously this big epidemic with UCL tears, and we've seen it over the years. It's gotten worse, I think. Why do you think that is? And as Cressy Performance, what are you trying to do to prevent that with your athletes? What is some of the discussions around your staff and then even the stakeholders that are, you know, sending you their players? What's that discussion look like?
You know, I think it's, you nailed it. I mean, it's a huge, huge problem, and it has not gotten better. It's gotten exponentially worse. I think it's pretty obvious that the increase in arm injuries has, at least at major league level, it has gone pretty much linearly alongside the increase in average fastball velocity. So as we've chased greater and greater fastball velocities, we've seen a higher level of performance, but we've also seen a higher level of injuries. I think we know that at all levels. The challenge, though, unfortunately, is that we're seeing kids break younger and younger. And you know, we're seeing kids have Tommy John at 15, you know, and then they're going to have a second one in their, you know, early to mid 20s, and then potentially a third one by the time they're 30. Like, let's be real, a lot of those 15 year olds that have Tommy Johns aren't going to make it, you know, past college baseball. It's just the way that it works. So there's too much lost development when you sit out for 14 months. So I think that is a big problem. Dr. Meister has been, you know, shouting from the rooftops that it's not just that we're seeing more injuries, that the injuries that we're seeing are actually catastrophic. It looks like a bomb goes off in some of these elbows. You know, what I've seen actually a lot more of is it's crazy to see how much, not just calcification, but we have ligaments that are literally just becoming bone. You know, we're seeing heterotopic ossification in some of these scenarios, just people who have these low-grade injuries that build and build and build, and eventually you have a ligament that just goes. And that's the challenge about it. It's like, we can get a kid at age 19 and do everything we possibly can right, but he might have been broken goods for 3 years before we ever got him. So I really think that you know, as much as we want to look at perfect biomechanics and workload management and trying to develop pitchers that, you know, are 91 instead of 99, and that's a whole other conversation. I think the most important thing that any of us can do, you know, and especially MLB, I've shouted this from the rooftops, is they've got to get more involved on the grassroots. You know, you can't let people be selectively adherent to pitch counts. Like, that doesn't work. You have to create some pretty aggressive guardrails for the industry as a whole. I don't think Major League Baseball scouts should be at events in October and November and December. They just shouldn't be allowed. It should be a scouting dead period. You know, if they want to go watch some college fall ball, that's a different story. But for them to be out there watching sophomores in high school try to blow up a radar gun the second week in October is the most ridiculous thing we could possibly imagine, you know? So I have some pretty strong opinions on that side of things. You know, I think it's interesting. I'm going to Dr. Ma's conference this weekend. You know, I spoke at a ASMI, the, you know, annual, you know, injuries in baseball sports medicine conference back in January of 2020, right before COVID, and was on a panel with Mike Reinold, with Kevin Wilk, with Dr. Altchek, Dr. Andrews. And you know, the panel really kind of deviated towards like weighted balls are a huge part of the problem. And, you know, don't get me wrong, I think weighted balls have been misused pretty heavily, but I think in general, there are so many things that cause the problem. To just isolate that one thing is kind of short-sighted. The problem is that people are selling out for velocity at all the wrong times. They're completely inverting the developmental pyramid. And the problem is that if you want to take a responsible approach to development, it might take a little bit longer, but it's way more sustainable. So it takes some coaches, some parents, you know, and frankly, some kids who, you know, have the guts to kind of stand up to the industry norm and, you know, kind of just chart a different path that I think can work much, much better.
Yeah, I mean, I have to agree. I think the big thing that we deal with is kids playing multiple leagues. They're playing town league, they're playing a high school league, they might be playing another league on top of that, travel league. It's not being tracked across the paradigm, right? So you're not tracking through everybody, you're tracking through one sport or one team. They are supposed to report it. Do they really report it? You're not counting warmups, you're not counting in between inning pitches, you're not counting if they're going to a position out after they come off the mound, are they going to catcher, are they going to shortstop? So there's a lot of stuff that needs to be done to correct it. I think they did a good job with trying to generalize pitch counts, but again, it's still a problem, right? And then I really have a strong feeling about them just not developing or not having developed in the right way. Like if they saw someone like you ahead of time and said, hey, you know what, I'm noticing that I'm weaker, we're doing an assessment, we're finding that they have a lot of posterior chain problems, we're noticing that their cuff's weaker, we noticed that after 20 pitches, they're dropping their arm in the slot and then they're getting elbow pain. Like, how do we change a lot of that stuff biomechanically with them to reduce the risk, right? So I think there's definitely a lot to do. But again, it's, you said, they're seeing things on YouTube, they're watching their buddies, they're watching big leaguers throw these massive fastballs that are hitting high 90s or over 100, and they're trying to do that, or they're throwing curves too early before they're done developing and their growth plates are closed. So then they end up having a problem on that end. So I definitely think there's a lot of, and that's the biggest problem, I think, is how do we fix it, one, on the strength conditioning side, but how do we fix it on the developmental side? And when do we say, hey, they can only play one team per season, right? Instead of having them do multiple seasons, I mean, multiple teams during those seasons.
If I'm being honest, like, you can prevent youth, put it this way, all right, I played baseball up until eighth grade. I was a mediocre third baseman and I was a better tennis player. So my tennis career was kind of chartered for me, but I didn't know a single kid who had an arm surgery when I played. I graduated high school in 1999. It didn't exist, right? I knew one kid who had an ACL reconstruction. But this was a very, I went to high school with, you know, 800 kids. So it wasn't like we didn't have a decent sized athletic department. So when I look at things now and what's happening, you can chalk every injury up to two things. It's either a really good kid that gets completely overused by a coach that's chasing fake trophies in a 12-year-old division, or it's frankly parent idiocy. Like, plain and simple. Like, I'll give you an example. We had a kid that, high motivation kid, came in with a, you know, little league elbow, so growth plate injury. Basically, doctor told him 6 to 8 weeks off. We both know it's usually longer than 6 to 8 weeks. So I always have mixed feelings about when they actually throw a timeline on it. I'd rather just see follow-up imaging that everything looks good and kind of progress from there. But kid was a good soldier, went through all of it. We got him on a nice return to throwing program. Dad was super on board. Everything was great. Kid comes in, and we're talking about 11 or 12 year old. So built up his long toss gradually, got out to 120 feet, which is a long way for an 11, 12 year old. That's like a big leaguer throwing 240, right? So did all that, then went to practice that night and did it again. And then that was a Monday. And then we did the same thing on Wednesday, doubled up his throwing program and then had a setback. It's like there's a reason you have a sequential development and all this stuff is happening. But I remember Kevin Wilk dropped that line. Teenagers only know one speed and it's stupidity. And I think that's the problem is like a lot of us parents, we grew up in the era of like, you know, just go outside and, you know, play a million sports, right? Wiffle ball, you know, tackle football, whatever you can possibly find. Ultimate Frisbee, you name it, we did it all. But now it's so hyper-specialized, so hyper-competitive. And there's really no broad base of foundational development that's going to set guys up for success. That's the problem. You can do a lot more if you actually build like a robust foundation of work capacity and skill-specific strength and all that stuff. But nobody's doing that. It's easier just to put them on five teams and, you know,
hope for the best. And we really think that they're chasing the college scholarship too. I mean, that's the problem. College is so damn expensive. I mean, our daughter is finishing her second year of grad school. And I mean, I don't even want to know what it's going to cost you when your kids go to college, but it's like, it's completely ridiculous. And I can see why they're chasing it. Right.
Our financial advisor told us $600,000 per kid. And I told him I'd rather give him a Lamborghini and let him put $300,000 in the market.
It's unbelievable. You
know? Yeah.
I just feel like now that there's this specialization and they get one coach that says, hey, you know what? You have something, you're going to make it, you know, and then you're dealing with that in the back of the parent's mind. They're like, hey, you know what? I can save myself $300,000, $400,000, $500,000. Like, and then it's a sacrifice the kid. And then they get upset when the kid gets hurt. Then they get upset with you when you can't hold the timeline. So there's a lot of that going on, right? So I think there's got to be a change. Like you said, it's either parent or coach or both. And then the kid ends up eating it up too. So
I've probably, I mean, you've been at this a long time too, is I think I've just gotten a little bit, I don't know, maybe I'm a little bit abrasive. Like I'm super direct with parents now. You know, like I have daughters myself. This is what I would do if this was my daughter. I think that's a terrible idea. I have no problem saying that to a parent. I think you're making an egregiously poor decision, like in progressing it like this way. And the reason I know is because I can walk them outside my office door and there are 20 big leaguers on the gym floor who did it the right way, who are late bloomers, who figured it out much, much later on, you know, and have had sustainable, durable big league careers. Like it's crazy to me that, you know, that we have 13-year-olds that are just, they're just making all these poor decisions. It's because it's so preventable at that age. You want to talk about like, you know, a 28-year-old relief pitcher in the big leagues, making 70 appearances a year, throwing 98 to 100 with a wipeout sweeper. It's hard to keep that guy healthy. That's a legit, you know, we'll talk about sleep quality. We'll talk about pitch track metric. We'll look at all that stuff and every kind of recovery option there is. But like a 13-year-old, like even college baseball, like pitch on a 70 rotation, it shouldn't be hard to keep guys healthy. You get into Major League Baseball when you're, you know, 162 games, like we played 48 games in 51 days or at one point in 2022, or excuse me, in 23. In 2022, we played 3 games in 24 hours in 2 different time zones. Like it's a totally different world at the Major League level, but we shouldn't be having these problems with like little kids. It's embarrassing.
Yeah, 100%. What do you find most rewarding about your job? Well, what's the biggest thing?
It's the relationships, it's the people always, you know, it's, you know, and I think it's also very flattering. People trust you with their career. They trust you with their children at a time when they're, you know, very young and impressionable and you're trying to foster, you know, a favorable lifelong relationship with exercise and all that stuff. So, you know, that's certainly like a very big, you know, responsibility that we don't take lightly. But at the end of the day, it's always the relationships. We were talking there. We have 9 kids that are in the big leagues that were with us when they were still in high school, like where we've seen through high school, college, minor leagues, all the way up. And, you know, now seeing those guys paying it forward and, you know, like Jesus Lizardo's got a big charity event coming up and he was with us when he was a sophomore in high school. It's crazy to see how these guys, Tyler Beattie came in as a, you know, sophomore. He's about to have his second kid. Like it's crazy to me. I'm feeling pretty old.
It is amazing. And I have to second that. I think the relationships are huge. When I started back in, I got a college in 96. So I think a lot of the undergrad anyway, and a lot of the kids that I've taken care of over the years have come back. They've called me when they've got injured in college. I had one that's now an upper extremity surgeon in Arizona. When he hurt his hand in medical school, he called me. I'm like, why are you calling me? You know? So, I mean, and then you start to see their kids. They move back to the town where I'm still, you know, at Weston, and they say, you know, you can't retire till my kids go through high school, which is another 6 or 7 years. So again, it's that same type of thing. You know, you did something right with them, by them, and that's the most rewarding out of the whole process. I have to agree.
No doubt about it. It's pretty cool to see generations too. My mom was a high school principal. So, you know, she went back to teaching in 1986 when I was in kindergarten. So she was seeing like 3 generations of kids by the time she retired.
That's pretty cool. That's good stuff. How do you value mentorship, and who is one of your biggest mentors, or who do you still go to for that?
It's huge. I always emphasize our facility is not just a training facility. We're a teaching facility. We're always trying to, you know, pay it forward and develop the next generation of coaches so we can leave the industry better than it found it. You know, I had a few different people, honestly, like in my own kind of personal journey. There was a guy named Daryl Conant, who was a personal trainer in my hometown, who kind of took me under his wing when I was, you know, struggling with some exercise addiction / eating disorder stuff in my, you know, my late teenage years. And he kind of helped get me on the right path and gave me my first opportunity working at his gym and even just working the front desk and helping out with cleaning and stuff like that. That's where I kind of caught the gym bug and really wanted to do this for an extended period of time. So I owe a lot to him. And then really once I got to grad school, you know, I was fortunate to study under some great professors, Dr. you know, Carl Marish and William Kramer, and just brilliant people there. But really Chris West, who was a strength addition coach at the University of Connecticut, took me under his wing. Brijesh Patel was there, who's now at Quinnipiac. Tina Murray was there. It was just kind of like a great breeding ground for excellent coaches. And they, you know, they gave me a really good opportunity to, you know, be involved, not just in coaching, but like gave me a say with some of the programming, some of the evaluation stuff we did. Just being around high level athletes was really, really important. So, you know, I think if you look at most people that have 23 years in this industry now, like it's hard to say it was just one mentor, because you have different people that were at different stops along the way and they mentored you in different ways. Like, you know, I've had awesome people, you know, good friends like, you know, Alan Cosgrove and Pat Rigsby, who have shared some really good wisdom on the business side of things, which has really helped as well. So everybody kind of has it takes a village, right?
It does. It does. And you have to have more than one person. You said it best, I think. And you don't keep, you know, asking the questions and making yourself better and doing the research, then you become stagnant, right? And then become obsolete.
Yeah, absolutely. That's it. It's such a dynamic field. It's changing every day. So you never want to get comfortable.
My buddy said it best. One of my a close friend growing up, went to high school together, went to Northeastern together. He goes, you got to water your grass. That's what you got to do every single day. And if you don't do that, your grass doesn't grow. It's the same with your career. So it's actually pretty simple. And it's 100% true. What advice do you have for any inspiring, you know, strength conditioning specialists, entrepreneurs going into the business, maybe someone that's in the business that's looking to go out on their own? What's some of the advice you have for them?
I was going to say, if you're an aspiring strength conditioning coach, there's nothing more important than your internship. Like, you know, you can read every book on the planet. You can go to every college class there is. You can study whatever you want to study, but nothing will prepare you better than getting out in the real world and just like struggling, you know what I mean? Like throwing a coaching cue at a young athlete, not getting the outcome you wanted. You've got to really like learn to adjust and be more efficient while being relatable, making it fun, all that stuff. So the internship is so important. It fast tracks your development. And don't make the mistake of just, you know, picking the place that's down the street. Like be willing to commit to traveling, going somewhere that could be transformational for you. Like I know a lot of people who have come through our internship program. I mean, you know, Eric Otter's director of sports medicine for Memphis Grizzlies, Doug Davidson, you know, won a Stanley Cup. Las Vegas, Eric Yavroni beat me in the World Series with the Dodgers. Like we have more former interns that are out there doing amazing things, not just in professional sport, but the college realm, private sector. You know, we have some that have gone to med school and become orthopedic surgeons, doing some really, really cool stuff. But it's so much about the mentors that, you know, you find and the people that help you along the way in that internship. We're specific to people going out on their own. I would tell people, like, it's the old Michael Gerber book, The E-Myth. He talks about the technician, the entrepreneur, and the manager. And early on, you need to do all three of them. And eventually, you need to find some people that can complement you and take some of that off your plate. But remember that some days, like running a gym is no different than running a restaurant or an accounting firm or dentist office or something like that. There's always parallels to other businesses. So I always enjoy talking to other entrepreneurs, you know, getting advice there. And if you're going to start a place, get yourself a good accountant, get a good lawyer, protect against downside, all of that important stuff. But if you want to build a business, solve a problem. If you have a problem to solve and you're good at what you do, you'll be rewarded for it with a good long career.
Yeah, well said. I think the internship thing too speaks volumes, because I went to Northeastern, so I went through the co-op program, but our internships as well. So we were constantly trying just to get into something that was going to help us, you know, kind of be able to collaborate and work with others. And that's how I got my job coming out of Northeastern, is through my internship program. So it was huge. And I tell my daughter the same thing. She's finishing her speech pathology graduate degree, and she was complaining about hour and 15 minute commute to her externship. And I said, listen, that could be the job they're going to provide for you after school. I said, you have to put the time in. It's only 3 months. And after speaking to her and her understanding the reason why, she's glad she took what she did, you know, so for her, just understand that, you know.
Remember that internship too, it's the one place where they can evaluate not just competency, but also fit. And you should appreciate that too. Like I did a cardiac and pulmonary rehab internship and I learned a ton and I actually enjoyed myself, but it made me realize that I was not a fit for clinical exercise physiology. I didn't enjoy it. I couldn't have done that for an entire career. So maybe I was competent enough to pull it off, but it's not where I wanted to spend the next, 50 years of my life. So, and potential employers are evaluating whether you're a good fit for their culture. Like, I love it. We have a kid from our current internship class that just pulled aside. I'm like, we're not letting you leave. You're a star. We want to keep you. Wrote him a contract offer, because it's not just that he's competent. Like, we can see that, but there's a fit. He's got a growth mindset. He gets along great with the rest of our coaches. He's always got a smile on his face. He's got spring in his step, never takes days off, played college baseball. Mom is a coach. He checks so many, he's trying to learn Spanish. He's checking so many boxes that that's what you can see. It's not just show up and take a test on day one and we'll tell you if you're competent. No, you got to demonstrate it and you got to be part of a team that's excited to work with you.
Yeah, 100%. Couldn't have said it better. Fun fact about you.
Ooh, I'm getting back into tennis.
Are you?
Tennis was my go-to. I worked at a club actually for 8 summers growing up. I strung rackets, swept in line courts, all that stuff. And my wife and I had a heart to heart. She was like, you need a hobby. Because I effectively have 3 full-time jobs. And so, it's one of those things where, I've been in a weight room. I competed in powerlifting for so long. After decades, the same old, lifting 4 days a week and doing some conditioning on the VersaClimber. And day of
the VersaClimber is death. Fun.
Yeah, exactly. So every Tuesday at 3:30, I go and I play tennis. And I basically told the guys, yeah, I want to get good at tennis again. I want to get it back. But more importantly, I want to be exhausted when I leave. So just make sure you drill me pretty hard. So I'm 3 months in and it's actually coming back. I'm old and I'm sore in all different places. I actually had a little
intercostal strain. It gets worse, man. I'm telling you, once you get over 50, it's get out of bed feels good.
I can still do all the dumb stuff I used to. I just can't get past it. But I'm I was actually kind of joking about it with one of our pro guys. I'm like, I think I pulled my intercostal yesterday. I didn't think I could actually rotate enough to even do that. So I was kind of actually proud of myself. Little grade one.
Yeah. I was the other day, I was am I having a heart attack? I'm like, oh, I did wide grip bench. You don't realize it takes you 4 or 5 days now to recover. I can't do that every day anymore.
That's my fun factor. Yeah. It may not be fun if I blow out an Achilles or something like that, but for now I'm enjoying it.
That's good. That's good. Well, listen, I appreciate the time on a Sunday evening after the Thanksgiving holiday. I hope your family feels better. You said they weren't feeling too well.
Oh, it's all good.
All the best, all the luck. Just don't beat up on us too much next year. And I do appreciate it. Maybe we can pick this up again and talk about lower extremity, maybe.
We'll do it, man. Thanks so much for having me. This is fun. Great question. And I always enjoy catching up.
Thanks, Eric.
Thanks for listening to Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast. Follow us on social media, watch full episodes on YouTube, and check out our website.
The information shared on this podcast is for educational and informational purposes only and is not intended as medical advice. Please consult a licensed healthcare provider for guidance related to your specific situation. We'll see you next week.